Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So the Government Accountability Office, GAO, has weighed in on the temporary withholding of security funds, defense support funds for Ukraine, back last year, and finds that the Trump administration broke the law. This is their conclusion. Faithful execution of the law does not permit the president to substitute his own policy priorities for those Congress has enacted by law. The funding freeze last summer was ran afoul of the law. And so now the Democrats have their smoking gun.
Oh, they were so excited yesterday.
Now they have a specific opinion on a law that was broken. And so the president will be removed from office, right? Wrong, of course. First of all, just as a point of order, the GAO, which, of course, is being characterized as a nonpartisan government agency. The phrase nonpartisan government agency belongs on the ash heap of history with objective news outlet.
Okay.
There is no such thing, number one. Number two, the GAO is a administrative agency, not a law enforcement agency. So, for example, this is there is disagreement about the GAO's interpretation here from the OMB. Not to get into too much alphabet soup, but the Office of Management and Budget, we disagree with the GAO's opinion. OMB uses its apportionment authority to ensure taxpayer dollars are properly spent consistent with the president's priorities with the law. And they go on to suggest that there is some discretion here under the Impoundment Control Act. The president can freeze funds in limited circumstances, including if it's to help programs run more efficiently. GAO said the administration didn't follow the legal procedures for notifying Capitol Hill of the hold, but OMB disagrees.
What does the DAN think?
Yes, exactly.
The DAN, and the AMY of the WIND.
The DAN thinks that the impeachment is still DOA. That's what the DAN thinks. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Our friend over at the Wall Street Journal, James Freeman, who writes the Best of the Web column, he asks pertinent questions in response to this. So just for the sake of argument, let's assume the GAO is correct now. Wouldn't the logic of this decision also apply to Vice President Joe Biden's famous withholding of Ukraine aid until the local prosecutor investigating his son's company was fired? Right?
Yeah.
Back in 2014?
Yep.
Oh, we got another one. Back in 2014, the GAO also ruled that Obama's prisoner swap of five detainees at Gitmo in exchange for prisoner swap, the five Taliban terrorists that were imprisoned at Gitmo in exchange for Bo Bergdahl.
Yeah.
They
what
found
did they say on that?
That violated federal law. The Department of, quote, the Department of Defense violated Section 8111 of the Department of Defense Appropriations Act when it transferred five individuals detained at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to the nation of Qatar, or Qatar, if you prefer, without providing at least 30-day notice to certain congressional committees. The DOD should report its Anti-Deficiency Act violation as required by law. Now, part of this just goes to the Byzantine reams of federal regulations we have, right? When the law is unknowable, you will no longer have the rule of law, even for practitioners of it, even for legislators, even for agency heads. So this is why the GAO is an administrative body and not a law enforcement body. And then if there were material violations of federal regulations or federal statutes, then that's when law enforcement would ostensibly get involved. It didn't in the case of Obama, of course. It's not going to in the case of Trump, of course. And more importantly, what would Democrats say about the GAO's opinion of what the Obama administration did, how they ran afoul of federal strictures in 2014, or, frankly, Joe Biden in real time? But at least you have a GAO opinion on the Obama administration in 2014. So should he have been impeached? Where were you guys when, oh, my gosh, the GAO weighed in and they said an administration ran afoul of the law? Remove that man from the Oval Office.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Yeah, I watched CNN a lot yesterday, and they were rejoicing over this GOA report. And you know who they had on to talk about it? Joe Walsh. And he fell flat because he didn't read the report. It was really embarrassing.
Well, it's a par for the course for CNN. It's just one embarrassment after the other. But I just wanted to start there. Let's clear the air on this GAO thing because
it came
over
Bible.
Comes over the transom and everybody runs around. Finally, we have a law that we can point to. Somebody saying that President Trump violated the law, that's not just a partisan hack on the Hill. And so, of course, they grabbed onto that. And then Nancy Pelosi used that talk about impeachment and all of the new evidence coming forward. Lev Parnas's statements and now this.
This is just another avoiding of the facts and the truth on their part. They don't want to see documents. They don't want to hear from eyewitnesses. They want to ignore anything new that comes up. We saw a strong case and infallible, undeniable case for the impeachment of the president. So that no future president would ever think that she or he could get away with what President Trump has been getting away with in his view. Any further evidence should not be avoided. And now the ball is in the court of the Senate.
So there you have it. It's the infallible case versus the perfect phone call.
I mean, she said Republicans are afraid of the truth. It's not the Senate's job to submit new evidence. That was the House's job, and Senator David Perdue said that to Manja.
Do you think the Senate should consider new evidence as part of the Senate trial that
Absolutely
has come out?
Not.
Why not?
Because that's not our job. The job is to respond to what we've been given in the case that was built by the House. They've given us two very weak articles of impeachment. Our job is to look at what they brought us and decide if that rises to the level of impeachment.
Sounds like David Perdue can handle the truth.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy talking about the latest developments in impeachment as the Senate was sworn in, as was Judge Justice Roberts yesterday, and this GAO statement that came out suggesting that the administration had violated the law by temporarily withholding those security funds for Ukraine. Mike in Union, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. Hey, a couple of points. Last night, Professor Dershowitz had brought up the fact that the GAO, being an arm of the Congress, cannot set policy or foreign policy, which was what Donald Trump was doing. Therefore, it's not against the law. Secondly, Rince Priebus brought up a good point last night regarding this Lev Parnas gentleman. Geez, what the hell was I going to say? I forgot.
Is that memorable, huh?
No worries.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got it. It was the Rachel Maddow show. At the end of the Rachel Maddow show, it transitioned over to Lawrence O'Donnell, and he congratulated her on her interview. Her response was, yes, thanks. I've been working on it for weeks now, which just goes to prove how political this all is. And then one last point, John Bonham was a better drummer than Neil Peart. Sorry about that, Dan.
I don't know about
there
that.
There we go.
Moby Dick.
Yeah, I know.
Thanks, brother.
I hear you. Thanks for calling.
Dan, what do you think?
You know, scholars hotly debate this. I appreciate the perspective. Dan in Libertyville.
Thanks for taking my call. Hey, you know, I see this as being a big boon for President Trump, especially if they allow witnesses to be called on par for everyone the Democrats call, the Republicans call one. This could become the greatest shift show ever, in which it shows the Democrats to be as dumb as they are and opening up Pandora's box of which they will never be able to close again.
Thanks for the call, Dan. Yeah, I don't know that I'm supportive of going down the road of witnesses. I just don't think it's necessary. But it is interesting. I mean, right now, the Democrat establishment is in full panic over the prospect of Comrade Bernie getting momentum, winning Iowa, winning New Hampshire, and starting to really be the front runner in the race. They're worried about that. That's why you've seen op-eds against that prospect from Obama world and Clinton world this week from their flacks.
Well, yeah.
So consider this. Consider Joe Biden testifying at that impeachment trial. And you've seen Joe Biden on the debate stage. You've watched Joe Biden for the past 40 years.
It's painful.
Think how well he would hold up. This is the guy they're essentially defaulting to at present. You want him on the Hill being cross-examined by Republicans? He's had trouble keeping the story straight without any cross-examination, just in terms of prepared remarks or certainly game-planned remarks about his involvement, lack of involvement, conversations, lack of conversations with Hunter Biden.
He can't remember what bills he voted for and what he did. He can't remember talking to his son.
On topic, right, on Burisma itself. So, you know, for all of the spoiling for witnesses from Schumer and Pelosi, one would think that would cut against the notion that you have a desire for Joe Biden to be the nominee or confidence that he can be. Because I just don't see how you watch his performance and say, we're willing to risk Joe Biden's performance on the Hill in order to get, John Bolton and Mick Mulvaney before the same committee. I don't know. Biden holds up?
Yeah, he's going to be a disaster.
And if Biden doesn't hold up, then who do you got? You think that's a way to reignite Elizabeth Warren's campaign? Or does that just further clear the field for
you can have
Bernie?
You have four senators off the campaign trail. And if Biden has to testify, then Buttigieg has the state to himself in Iowa.
Yeah, that's totally overblown. I don't buy that. By the way, that's the Beltway conventional wisdom PAP.
What do you mean? If they're off the campaign, Iowa caucuses are 17 days away. And Bernie But Bernie Sanders did not like being in Washington, D.C. He wanted to be in Iowa.
I would rather be in Iowa today. There's a caucus there in 2.5 weeks.
Yeah.
I'd rather be in New Hampshire. And in Nevada and so forth. But I swore a constitutional oath as a United States Senator to do my job, and I'm here to do my job. And I think the people of the United States understand that.
I mean, because they're going to have to be, they're in there, they have no cell phones, so there's no communication. Each manager presents 16 to 24 hours, and then, no one's going to remember them, but they're not going to be where the action is and where they need to be.
Yeah. I appreciate regurgitating what you've been spoon-fed from all your CNN watching. Consider this. Consider that the biggest issue motivating the base of the primary electorate in the Democrat Party right now is impeachment. And considering this, everybody gets their star turn on TV in an impeachment proceeding.
They have to written questions. They're not talking. They're listening.
And then they're commenting every single day after the fact. And this is good.
They handed out a card of this is what you're supposed to do when the media approaches you.
And this is
please move out of my way.
Uh-huh.
You're preventing me from doing my job. Please excuse me. I'm trying to get to the Senate floor.
And this is going to be the story that the media is hyper focused on. So where do you want to be where the media is? This will overshadow whatever's going on in Iowa. By the way, Bernie Sanders, sort of a known quantity. He ran in 2016, you'll recall.
Yeah, I know.
He's got the boots on the ground. You know, the people in Iowa right now are not confused about who these people are. And one more pancake breakfast is not going to be determinative in the caucus.
You don't know if there's some undecided voters.
Yes, there are undecided voters, and they'll move around. But the personal touch of a Bernie Sanders for the 47th time over the course of 3 years is not going to be important as Bernie Sanders being able to say, hey, I wish I could be there, but I'm doing my constitutional duty to take out bad orange man. And the others will say the same thing. The idea, this gives Mayor Pete the run of the field, and oh my gosh, that is spoon-fed pablum from the Beltway Press Corps.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy and Lev Parnas. Since the media wants to try this case on their platform. Okay.
All right. Where do we begin?
Well,
start with his hair plugs.
Christiane Amanpour, she did an interview of Ukrainian Foreign Minister Vadim Prosteko. And I don't think it turned out exactly how she had hoped. You know, here's the other problem with impeachment right now. As John Ratcliffe said during the House proceedings, in order to impeach one president, you have to impeach two. You have to say that Ukrainian President Zelensky and his team are liars. So are they liars? Somebody say that. I want to hear a Democrat say they're lying. Why haven't we heard that? They enjoy bipartisan support, the Zelensky administration. You wouldn't have had the security aid without bipartisan support. So is Zelensky a liar?
I believe Zelensky.
Why does anybody ask that question? Or they just pat him on the head. He doesn't have agency. He's got to say these things. He's got to go along to serve the interests of his country to continue to enjoy the aid. Why does he? Why does he have to do that? He didn't go along with the Burisma investigation that supposedly was the predicate for aid. What has he done?
Got the aid.
What has he done since? Has there been an investigation into Hunter Biden since? Not that I'm aware of. Are they aware of it? How about these questions? These are the questions you won't get from the CNN teleprompter readers that serve as basically Jeff Zucker puppets. But Amanpour put the questions to Ukrainian Foreign Minister Vadim Prosteko, her questions, like about Lev Parnas. What do you know about him? Have you had any interaction with him? What do you think about what Lev Parnas had to say in his Maddow and Anderson Cooper turns yesterday?
It's all over Ukrainian media as well today and yesterday. And strangely enough, my name was not mentioned, although I'm Minister of Foreign Affairs. And frankly, I never spoke with this individual. And again, frankly, I don't trust any word he is now saying. The assistance which he is referring to was reviewed on each and every year annually, at least twice, and half a year at the end of the year. So we knew that this assistance is to be reviewed. Sometimes it would be cut because of some political understanding of what is to be done in Ukraine. Sometimes it's being erased, which is now we're observing. At the end of the year, we would receive even more than it was planned. I understand that this individual, which I don't know personally, but he is now trying to save his own case. And I don't trust what he's saying. And I was so tired of these questions about our role in impeachment. What we are trying to tell Americans that we are so happy to have bilateral support from both parties, and we will be happy to have it as well. Thank you.
You want to tamp down the celebration? How do you think Lev Parnas would hold up under scrutiny in an impeachment proceeding?
Well, I think he would lie because he's a proven liar, and he has serious credibility issues. I mean, 4 counts of campaign finance violations. He knew that they were going to arrest him, so he bought a one-way ticket to Ukraine with his buddy Igor. And and Jake Tapper did mention that interview with Christiane Amanpour, saying that, you know, Democrats, cool your heels here, that you can't, you know, you have to question his story.
Well, you can't
act like he's Theodore Roosevelt.
I don't know. It sounds like Democrats are colluding with the Russians, right? Parnas is a Soviet born. Speaking more on the topic, what about Rudy? Mr. Foreign Minister, were you being run by Rudy and his associates?
I never met Rudy. I never met this Parnas and all other names mentioned. I believe that people are now trying to raise their political importance. I never had the chance. And frankly, we don't need this channels. Our channels of communication with Americans are well established. If some of the unofficial contacts through the advisors, that's why advisors for. We took the official formal part. We were happy with the conversation. I was at all the meetings and the conversation is a telephone on the person with President Trump. And I can tell you with all certainty that he was never mentioned that we have to do something. And President Zelensky was always telling him that whatever this message and this and lesson you were teaching us all these 30 years of our independence, that it should be rule of law and should be independent judiciary and prosecutor general from the president, we finally got the message. We are not going to intervene because of some political gains. We told him, if you have information, send it through the official channels, which is prosecutor general's office. You have your prosecutor general, we have ours. Let them talk, cooperate. If anything to be investigated, let's investigate this.
We didn't need unofficial channels of communication because we're happy with the official channels of communication. They're working quite well. Foreign Minister Prosteko never met with Rudy or Parnas, so he says. So how do you want to factor that into the conspiracy theorizing of the left?
Did you see it, Lev, on the full interview with Anderson Cooper was on last night? He dramatically, at the end of the interview, Dan, looks at the camera and says, I'm here, members of Congress. You know how to reach me, and I'm willing to testify. I mean, it was so cheesy and creepy, and he just...
So long as you can do something about that problem I have with the Southern District of New York.
Yeah, right. I mean, he's desperate, and Kellyanne Conway said that yesterday.
Quid pro quo. Oh, do we have the specter of a quid pro quo? A Russian offered quid pro quo. Prosteko, one other important Prosteko point, because this is something that the left was beating this drum. Oh, Mike Pence. Mike Pence, Parnas mentioned him. You know, he implicates Pence. He implicates Barr. Justice Department said what he's saying is completely untrue. Mike Pence, he was dispatched to turn the screws on Zelensky and his administration to do the Burisma investigation. And because we didn't do it, that's why Mike Pence didn't show up to the inauguration of Zelensky. That's why President Trump wasn't there, right? Wrong.
I can tell you why. We had some blame can be on our side because we had to do it in a very fast way. President Zelensky wanted to leave the parliament free from his new presidency, and we have just a couple of days to make it legal. We've been limited by ourselves by time. So we gave quite a short notice to all the nations. And in our case, in the American case, Secretary Perry came. We believe that we would have somebody else if we want to. If we give more time for the foreign delegations. So it was not a big deal for us. At least we didn't feel it. Whatever these individuals are saying, we invited, given just 1 week prior notice to delegations, and we received Secretary Perry, which was a good representation and good level. And I was at the conversations with Secretary Perry as well. Mm-hmm. And anything of the sort you were just referring never been mentioned in none of these conversations.
I love what Pence's office, their statement, quote, he'll say anything to stay out of prison. And Kelly Conway said, yeah, he's, you know, not under oath here, folks.
Nobody on TV like that is under oath. And he obviously is desperate to get attention.
Yeah. So this is I just go back. This is just the left repeating its approach to these matters over and over again, approach to politics generally. So Mr. Prosteko, President Zelensky, aren't you upset about Trump turning the screws on you? Yeah. And they say, no, that didn't happen. Well, I'm upset for you. You should be as upset about this as I am for you. Well, I'm not upset. This is radical chic. The Black Panther to Leonard Bernstein. Aren't you? Doesn't my opulent Manhattan penthouse disgust you? No, not really. Well, it disgusts me. Okay. Verlon on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I just want to ask, how many times are we going to let the Democrats get away with this nonsense? Have we forgotten about Kavanaugh? Have we forgotten about Russian collusion? And have we forgotten about the ramrodding of these nonsensical issues through the House? How many times are we going to let them play fast and loose and dirty and get away with this nonsense? What we need to do is not give them any credibility, don't pay them any attention, because the process was started tainted. So what do you think is going to happen in the end? It's going to be tainted. So let's just get this behind us. Let's just get to this election, vote our president back in, and vote these idiots out of office.
Thanks, Verlon. Mike Pence, speaking of him, has an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal which he concludes with this question. Who among the Senate Democrats will stand up to the passions of their party this time? Who will stand up against the legislative mob rule and the rule for law? Stand up against legislative mob rule and for the rule of law? Who will be the 2020 profile in courage? You see any candidates on the Dem side for the profile in courage moniker? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. You had Jeff Van Drew in the House say, and also the dude from Minnesota whose name is escaping me right now, but particularly Jeff Van Drew switching parties, say this impeachment thing is basically nonsense. He didn't make the case. Anybody on the Senate side suggesting anything of the sort? I mean, yeah, you have Republicans, some Republicans openly ruminating about wanting witnesses.
Yeah.
What about Democrats? What about some red state Democrats like Joe Manchin? They, at some point, are they going to have had enough of this?
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Ken in Plainfield.
Yeah, just listening to you, I think it would be almost interesting to present witnesses just because a simple line of questioning would destroy their credibility. Kind of reminds me of a documentary I saw about two youths in Alabama who got accused of a crime, and the one guy's cousin, Vinny, ripped them apart on the stand, all the witnesses.
Yeah, we'll see if Joe Pesci can be added to Trump's legal defense team.
Wouldn't that be great if he walked out?
Sure, yeah. Jay Sekula, for the defense, Your Honor, I'd like to turn over the rest of my time to my cousin Vinny. Mike in Crown Point, Indiana.
I got a hypothetical for you, Dan and Amy. Let's suppose Trump just got thoroughly discussed, said, you know what, I'm just resigned, and Pence gets appointed. How long do you think it'll be before Pelosi and those people are screaming impeach Pence?
Well, yeah, I think.
Well, yeah, they would do that immediately.
Thanks for the call. There was a hashtag trending on Twitter the other day, President Pelosi, when Lev Parnas said, Pence knew and he didn't go to the impeachment. He was dispatched to turn the screws on Zelensky. Well, Pence has to go, too. So, you know, get ready to usher Nancy Pelosi. I mentioned this yesterday. We have a Nancy Pelosi. Then she fires Barr. Then we elevate Adam Schiff to attorney general and all's with the world. Good Lord. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Hey, Dan and Amy. Colin Peterson is the guy's name.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
And there is no buddy like in the Johnson impeachment trial of 1868. There's nobody who's like a William Pitt descendant of Maine, who Maine was a very Republican, hardcore state, and he went against it. There's nobody like Graves of Kansas. Nobody. Nobody on the Democratic side.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Yeah, I'm sort of afraid you're right.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy and Mitch McConnell took to the Senate floor yesterday to remark upon the pomp and circumstance surrounding the House finally transmitting the articles of impeachment. This is pretty fun, actually.
All right.
Yeah. Talking of silver platters and golden pens.
After weeks of delay, the Speaker of the House decided yesterday that a trial could finally go forward. She signed the impeachment papers. That took place, Madam President, at a table with a political slogan stuck onto it. And they posed afterwards for smiling photos. And the Speaker distributed souvenir pens, to her own colleagues emblazoned with her golden signature that literally came in on silver platters. The pens literally came in on silver platters. Golden pens on silver platters. A souvenir to celebrate the moment.
That was great.
It is too, right? But
it was so goofy, and I felt like I was watching The Crown or something.
This is that, but they were. This is somber. They're reluctant. Oh, yeah.
This is very hard on us personally and professionally, Dan.
They're prayerful.
Oh, my God.
Not something they want to do, but the Constitution demands that they fulfill the duties they were sworn to carry
out. Are you going to cry?
I mean, it's silver platters and golden pens, too. I love that.
That's the name of your new book, right?
It really is, yes. My life story. But it's so ruling class, isn't it?
That's an episode of The Crown.
I guess I'm so inured to it, I didn't even pick up on that. But really, silver platters and golden pens. Yeah, it's great stuff.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and
intersection.
Arrogance and ignorance. Arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance.
Intersection.
The latest sport that women are going to be drummed out of. Long drive competition. The World Long Drive golf competition. Yeah. You know, that involves hitting the ball as far as you can within a certain spread. Australian Jamie O'Neill, born male, now identifying as female, is participating in the World Long, because the World Long Drive competition is allowing him to. Has a distinct advantage, you know, because he's a guy, and so he's stronger, and so he generates more club head speed and torque, and so the ball goes further.
He should be forced to use women's clubs.
Wouldn't matter.
You're right. He'd still win he's going to win. He's going to dominate. So there's another sport. Sorry, ladies.
You think it's all just like contact sports or sports where, you know, like the physical nature of them is so obvious. Even a sport like golf. Remember when Annika Sorenstam was gonna be on the men's tour?
Yes, I remember. I watched.
You watched her.
She did play in one tournament.
You watched her not make the cut.
She didn't make the cut.
Right.
Well, because they showed highlights of her and she tried to make the cut. There's women's tees for a reason. Okay, ladies, and it's okay to use them. I do.
The top 100 players on the PGA all have average driving distances of 300 yards plus.
That's kind of like you. Are you?
I do actually hit the ball.
I know. 300 yards plus. Right.
But
Being facetious. I was telling the truth.
But then the rest of my game.
But then, right.
But
we'll talk about your short game later. Yeah.
So club head speed. So top 100 players on the men's tour, 300 yards plus. The driving distance leaders on the LGBA tour, number one, Yanni Tsang, 276 yards.
That's pretty good.
Oh, it's great.
That's great.
But I mean, they hit the ball a lot further than a lot of men. There's just not men on the tour, not men playing professional golf, and that's it's the same thing here. This guy.
So is he a transgender? He's just feeling like a woman.
I don't know the particulars. That doesn't even matter in terms of the standards that are set.
They're taking over our sport.
In August, this guy's yardage was 280 yards. So that's August. So that's further than the leading driver on the LPGA Tour. December 2019, it was 301 yards. His goal is 350 yards by April 2020, which would pass the highest championship score ever recorded in the women's division since its inception. This, by the way, he's 43 and still has a huge advantage because of men are physically stronger than women. A study in the Journal of Applied Physiology found that men had an average of 26 pounds more skeletal muscle mass than women. Okay. Women exhibited about 40% less upper body strength, 33% less lower body strength on average. Yes, are there outliers? Fine. But that's not what we're talking about here. What we're somebody who can compete at that level who's an outlier. We're talking about crowding women out of sport. And I just wonder aloud again if maybe this is where the buck will finally stop. I don't know. Maybe not. You used to think it would be obvious. Well, parents are going to want their girls to be able to compete in sports and not be run over by guys. I don't know. I don't know that there's enough parents that have enough courage to say this is absurd. And I want my daughter to be able to play sports and derive all the benefits that playing sport, whether it's an individual or a team, or it's an individual sport, but you're part of a team, like, say, tennis or golf, that you derive from that. By the way, this also goes back, and we've talked about this so many times now, but the Venus Williams story. Serena Williams. When John McEnroe said something about her, you know, she would be like, she wouldn't be in the top 100 on the men's tour.
Gosh, no. There's no way in the world.
And she had said the same exact thing a couple years earlier, but because of politics insinuating itself in sport and destroying common sense about these matters, then she had to pretend she was all offended by what John McEnroe said, which she had said the exact same thing 2 years earlier. And she's, you know, she hits the, her serves are, you know, I don't know if they're still the fastest in the world, but they certainly were at the peak of her career. But it's still nothing compared to, you know, Djokovic on the men's side. I mean, come on.
Federer. I mean, there's no. And I mean, and we had this, and I told the story before, but it bears repeating. When we went to the championship game, our girls' team, and we played against two dudes. And I said to the coach, they're not transitioning. What are their names? And she said, you can't ask them. We don't ask names. I go, oh, okay, you don't ask names at your school? She said, no, we don't ask names. But it's the beginning of the end of girls' sports. And I told that coach that. I said, if you put them in, because I'm competitive and I win, and we've had 8 championships for a reason. Well, we do. And I'm competitive, and they're going to start doing that, then I'm going to pull boys and put them on the girls' team. And I don't want to do that.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
But parents, the whole point of this is parents did stand up and complain because they were out of their minds. Because you had a 6-foot-1 dude trying to slam a ball down a girl, my player, who was 4'9 and 75 pounds. That's called a possible broken bone or a broken nose. It's a safety issue.
And it doesn't matter whether they're just – whether they've had the reassignment surgery or they're just...
No, this is called cheating.
No, yeah, it doesn't matter. Just the science of this.
Right.
They say, the trans activists say trans women don't have a strength advantage over women because their testosterone levels drop so low, but that's not supported by the science. In fact, in 2019, a study published by the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism explored the effects of gender-affirming treatment on muscle function, size, composition, during 12 months of therapy, found that trans women generally maintain their muscle strength, size, and composition. The changes in strength going from, physically from man to woman, changes in strength are modest, concluded the study. So the idea that, oh, well, it'd be one thing if they actually had the reassignment surgery and the testosterone levels and this. No, it really wouldn't be. You're still going to have your daughter's still going to be marginalized in the chosen sport if you allow men to come in and play that sport.
Right, because eventually there's going to be no spots for the women to be on teams.
David and McCook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Happy Friday, guys. Hey, Dan, can you please explain to me why, if you and I compete in any given men's sport and we test positive steroids, we're going to be disqualified? But if we wake up tomorrow and say we feel like a woman, we're free to do whatever against women.
Well, it's a great point. Thanks for the call, David. You know, you've had female athletes disqualified for using testosterone as a performance enhancer, right? So, you know, that this has been the argument about trying to maintain some sort of standardization of female participants in sport when it comes to living in the age where gender is allegedly a social construct. You know, so forget identifying it by male or female. We'll identify it by testosterone level, and you have to, you know, be below this testosterone level in order to compete in a woman's sport. But it doesn't matter. That doesn't change anything because it doesn't change the physical strength. That's what this study I was just referencing indicates. So that's phony. That's just as phony as gender is a social construct. Joe in Villa Park.
Hey, you know, why don't bring it full circle to Chicago? You know, they're talking about set-asides now for transgender and gay people. So I could just lie and say, oh, yeah, I like my – I'm going to, you know, recognize as a woman and get better contracts. This is ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Joe. I want to get to one other intersection of sports and politics. This is from the college football championship game on Monday night in New Orleans.
Don't you dare touch my backside.
Kelly, no.
Oh, that one?
No, I'm not talking about Odell Beckham.
Odell Beckham. Well, he's getting arrested for that.
Yeah.
He smacked some. If people want to know, he was handing out cash on the field after the game to players. And then in the locker room when LSU was celebrating, he tapped a police officer on the behind.
Well, he did more than tap. He gave him a big, back behind, slapped him when the officer was telling the LSU players they couldn't smoke cigars.
Right. And he can't, why do you spoil the fun, man? And so then Beckham just hit him on the backside. You can't do that to the cops, guys.
No, this is about
a different one?
Kelly Holstein, who won the, Kelly Holstein, by the way, on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly Holstein, parentheses, she/her. So you know where this is going.
Oh, no.
Kelly Holstein is Minnesota's 2019 Teacher of the Year. Uh-huh.
Okay.
She was, and so I guess part of her prize was to be able to go to this game. This was for, courtesy of the Extra Yard for Teachers charity. And she knelt during the anthem. Knelt during the anthem.
What is she protesting?
What do you think?
President Trump.
You got it. I just decided that that it felt like the right thing to do to have a very respectful protest that was motivated by her concern for communities that are oppressed under the Trump administration. I mean, of course, I read this. I'm like, oh, Kelly Holstein knelt on the sidelines in protest of the Trump administration. Look at me.
Anybody? I'm over here.
This reminds me of one of my favorite stories from the height of the kneel down craze a few years ago. This is now 3 years ago. This is how long this nonsense has been going on, of course, because during the Trump presidency. Clay Travis, you know, the sports writer and broadcaster, Clay Travis talking about the fun run in his neighborhood. What happened at the fun run in his neighborhood? This is great.
This past weekend, Friday night, my wife went on a fun run in our neighborhood. It's like one of these glow runs or something, like for cancer research. You run like a 5K. I'll be damned if they didn't sing the national anthem before this fun run. Whatever, there's margaritas, beer. It's a charity event. Nobody's trying to set the record in the 5K. A dude took a knee while an 8-year-old girl sang the national anthem in the local neighborhood charity run. Can you try harder than to take a knee while an 8-year-old girl sings a charity run national anthem in a local neighborhood in this country?
So great. Mike on the north side. Mike on the north
Hello,
side.
Mike,
good morning.
Yeah. Let's go.
Good morning. Thanks
clock.
For taking my call.
Yeah.
Is it any surprise the liberals are like this? Look at Hollywood. I mean, 45 years after the fact, they still support that pedophile who's living out in France. Don't say his name. They still support him. So don't tell me they care about women's rights and a women's rights to choose. See, the problem is, Amy, you're playing these public schools. If this was a Catholic school, there's enough cops or firefighters or streets and sand workers among the fathers who would take the opposing coach outside and make him see the light. And if he couldn't see the light, they'd ask him, do you believe in Jesus? Because you're going to meet him in about 15 seconds.
Okay. All right, Mike, thanks for the call.
I said what I needed to say to her, and I postponed the game about 20 minutes because I was out of my mind and I needed to see the rules. And because they snuck these guys in. We were warming up for about a half hour, and then they kind of snuck them in. I'm like, whoa, what's going on here?
The only place where you might have might go the other way, this might be just out of necessity, women playing in men's sports is in baseball, Major League Baseball, for the Houston Astros, because we're on the cusp of every Houston Astro or everybody who's ever been a part of the Astro organization being suspended for at least a year from baseball.
I know. How are they even going to have a team this year?
This cheating scandal. It's remarkable. I mean, three managers have been canned already, all associated with this. I'm sure you've seen it about stealing signs during the 2018 World Series.
And then Beltran got fired yesterday from the Mets.
Yeah, well,
he hasn't even managed a game yet, but he's the third. Yeah.
Yeah, and so, and then there's the accusation that Altuve, their all-star second baseman, may have had some sort of buzzer device on his shoulder, and he may have been wearing it during Game 6 of the ALCS last year, where he hit that walk-off home run to beat the Yankees.
I don't understand the electronic thing that they're wearing and how that.
Well, there's no evidence to substantiate that claim. There's a claim that was made, but otherwise they were using cameras in center field, and they were using
signals.
Yeah, Morse code off a garbage can to communicate what pitches were coming.
Oh, that's right. And I heard some audio where you can hear like bang, 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 bang. And so then they knew it was going to be a curveball. You know, it was crazy.
And Pete Rose is banned for life.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
I don't want to get out ahead of ourselves here, but this was an interesting story in the New York Times. New York Times on Jim Comey. I know there's a lot of interest in having individuals held to account criminally for what it seems fairly clear from, say, Michael Horowitz's Inspector General reports, they did at FBI specifically, that seems to be of a criminal nature. You know, like lying to the FBI, Andy McCabe. What about leaking classified information, Jim Comey? Department of Justice prosecutors, according to this New York Times report, reportedly investigating the possibility that former FBI Director Jim Comey leaked a classified Russian intelligence document to the media during the investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails. The investigation is centered around two 2017 articles from The Times and Washington Post describing the Russian document, which played a key role in Comey's unilateral decision to announce in July 16 the FBI would not pursue charges against Clinton for using, her home-baked server. The document, which Dutch intelligence shared with the United States, includes an analysis of an email exchange between DWS, bring her back, Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, chairing the DNC at the time, and Leonard Bernardo, an official with the Soros-backed nonprofit Open Society Foundations. In the email, Wasserman Schultz assures Bernardo that then Attorney General Loretta Lynch would make sure Clinton wasn't charged in the email probe. Both Bernardo and Wasserman Schultz denied ever having that exchange. And the FBI's assessment claimed that the document was fake and part of a Russian disinformation campaign. But again, going back to Horowitz and the IG report, he found, among other things, that the former FBI director, that would be Comey, had a troubling lack of any direct substantive communication with Lynch over his decisions. So investigators are examining, again, reporting the Times, whether Comey's personal lawyer, Daniel Richmond, gave the Russian document to reporters. Richmond played a key role in a different confirmed leak that Comey orchestrated to hand over memos of his private encounters with President Trump in the early days of the Trump administration. Comey testified to that before Congress in June of 17. I asked a friend of mine to share the content of the memo with a reporter. I thought it might prompt the appointment of a special counsel, you recall. In August, Horowitz concluded that Comey violated policy and set a, quote, dangerous example, unquote, for the rank and file by retaining and leaking said memos. He referred Comey for potential prosecution over the matter, but DOJ declined to prosecute on that. That apparently hasn't ended their investigation, per this New York Times report. And, oh, goody, I'm glad it hasn't.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity. This afternoon at 2 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So earlier in the week, we had former First Lieutenant Clint Lawrence on. He served 6 years in Leavenworth for second-degree murder related to a decision he made while serving in Kandahar province in Afghanistan back in 2012
Yeah, there were three men on a motorcycle in Afghanistan approaching them, and he ordered others to fire on them.
He green-lighted American soldiers, to mm-hmm. open fire after he says that Afghan soldiers had initially opened fire because the three men on the motorcycle fit the profile of bad hombres, to borrow a phrase. It turns out that those individuals did have terrorist ties. They were, at least a couple of them, if I'm recalling correctly, from Clint, bomb makers. But nonetheless, he was court-martialed and convicted, and there were members of his platoon, and he was a newly minted senior officer in the platoon, that broke bad on him and testified against him. For more on this case and maybe the general matter, oh, and by the way, obviously this all culminated in November of last year when Trump pardoned him and ordered his immediate release. And so he was released as of November of 2019, along with a couple of other U.S. military that Trump intervened on behalf of, and not without controversy. For more on this topic, both specific to Clint Lawrence and generally, we're pleased to be joined by John Maher. He is lead attorney. He was an attorney for Clint Lawrence, but he's the lead attorney and founder of Lawyers Defending Warriors. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan and Amy, good morning, and thank you for having me on the show.
So we talked a little bit to Clint about the series, the documentary series on the Starz Network that that profiled his case, this story, and he, you know, said some of it they got right and some of it they didn't, but it just in terms of people probably getting a lot of their information about what transpired in terms of informing their decision on whether Trump made the right call or not. Tell us about the accuracy of that series and why you clearly think President Trump made the right move to get Clint Lawrence out of prison.
Sure. I'd like to point out at least 5 points where I believe in the legal team who represented Lawrence during his appeal and its search and quest for a pardon, that the president was indeed correct to exercise his authority to release Clint Lawrence. And here's why. He did not get a fair trial. The Constitution of the United States was absent without leave from Lawrence's court-martial. We didn't pick up the case until he was already in prison and in his appeal. When we began our appellate investigation, we discovered 5 main points of evidence that the prosecution had in its possession but did not turn over to the defense, and thereby the defense was not able to put on a compelling presentation to the jury, and the jury never knew the following. Number one, that the three riders on the motorcycle were not linked to terror. Instead, they were terrorists, and here's why. They left their fingerprints and their DNA on bomb parts at grid coordinates, which are map locations, where American paratroopers had been either killed or wounded previously. And that's important because had that information been presented to the jury, Lawrence was entitled to a jury instruction to say, pursuant to Rule for Court-Martial 916, that killing an enemy combatant in battle is justified. And that was a ground by which the jury could have found him not guilty and acquitted him. Secondly, the battle space commander issued what's called a significant activity report, a SIG Act. That was dated 1 month after Lawrence's engagement on July 2, 2012, in the Zare district of Kandahar province, Afghanistan. And in that report, the Army battle space commander concluded that Lawrence's platoon was being scouted for an impending attack or ambush, and that at least one enemy terrorist insurgent was killed. So Lawrence should have been able to use that report in his defense in front of the jury to say, the enemy was scouting us, and my decision to order fire was therefore lawful and reasonable. Don't take my word for it. Take the ground force commander's word for it. Third, and very compellingly, an aerostat operator, which is basically a giant blimp that floats over the battlefield, has powerful cameras on it, and the aerostat operator concluded, based upon his observations, that Lawrence's platoon was being scouted by 3 fighting-age males, dismounted, meaning on foot, armed with AK-47 assault rifles, and working with ICOM radios, and that he concluded that Lawrence, as the platoon leader, should be informed that he's walking into an ambush. The aerostat operator not only captured that footage, but made a written report to the Tactical Operations Center saying, you better warn that lieutenant. He's walking into an ambush and he's going to get hurt. The government never turned that over either. Fourthly, the command sergeant major of the squadron, he too walked combat patrols on that very ground. And he too concluded that three fighting age males on a single motorcycle at an excessive rate of speed riding towards an exposed platoon in a single file route of march behind a minesweeper in a known battle space, that it's reasonable under the rules of engagement to conclude that that presents hostile intent and a hostile act, especially if the Afghan National Army fired first. And then the fifth point is that Lawrence replaced the previous platoon leader who was wounded in action on the very same battlefield. He was medically evacuated from the field, and he gave a sworn written statement as he was convalescing in the hospital. That sworn written statement is three single-spaced typed pages, and only one sentence has been lined out, and that one sentence reads words to the effect of, "I would never, as platoon leader, let a motorcycle near my element for fear of what it would do." In other words, it could be a drive-by shooting. It could be a vehicle-borne IED. It could be a grenade toss. And all of those pieces of evidence, if you link them together, Lawrence has a powerful defense. And none of it was turned over, which is a violation of the Fifth Amendment.
Why wasn't it? Why didn't the government turn over the footage? And then also, why did members of his platoon not tell the truth?
Well, I'll take the second one first, Amy, if that's okay. Yeah. The members of the platoon, each of them was taken off the line, and each of them was accused of murder. Each of them was given a charge sheet. Each of them was then given immunity for in exchange for their testimony against the lieutenant. And none of that made it to the courtroom either.
Let's just hold there because I want to be specific. So Todd Fitzgerald, sure. Who was one of the soldiers deployed, he said that Lawrence is a murderer. He said, without a doubt in my mind, Lawrence is guilty, said Fitzgerald. He said that he and his former fellow soldiers were pretty much on the same page. He said, make no mistake about this. I mean, we turned him in. Make no mistake about that. So that doesn't sound like somebody necessarily being pressured to testify against somebody else in order to save himself. How do you explain Todd Fitzgerald's testimony?
In two ways. Number one, Todd Fitzgerald had a motive against Clint Lawrence because Clint Lawrence had disciplined Todd Fitzgerald the day of this patrol. Todd Fitzgerald was responsible for putting up a drone in order for the platoon to have eyes on the ground from the air, and Todd Fitzgerald failed in that mission. Secondly, Todd Fitzgerald didn't have the optics that Clint Lawrence had when he gave the order, and Todd Fitzgerald never mentions Private First Class Skelton. PFC Skelton is the first one to have spotted the three fighting age males on a motorcycle. And Skelton testified at trial that he complied with the rules of engagement because he perceived an actual threat and he was entitled to defend himself and defend the platoon. And on top of that, Lawrence never fired his rifle. Lawrence's order was based on Skelton's hasty rules of engagement assessment and threat assessment, and the fatal rounds that hit the riders, pursuant to five witnesses at trial, struck within 2 to 5 seconds when Skelton fired but missed. And so that's how it is, Brett. In a larger sense. Okay,
yeah, it's just important to note, I mean, just to, again, sort of get the fact pattern out so people understand the context and the circumstances. So the three men on this motorcycle were unarmed. Two of them were killed. But again, to your point about what First Lieutenant Dominic Latino said in his written testimony, this was the former platoon leader who was wounded by shrapnel from an IED, and that's how Lawrence came in to become the platoon leader, backfilling Dominic Latino. You got a motorcycle with three guys, and it fits this profile, and the Afghan soldiers, according to Lawrence, are saying stop, and they're not stopping, and you don't know if they're armed, or you don't know if they've got, like you said, a mobile IED. And so at a certain point, when they don't abide a stop order, what do you do?
Right, and that hesitation can be unforgiving. And here's an example. In December 2015 at Bagram Air Base, an Air Force National Guard out of New York City was conducting a dismounted patrol, meaning they're on foot. They let a motorcycle ride directly into their element. Nobody fired their rifle. Nobody fired their pistol. The rider detonated himself and killed 6 New York Air National Guardsmen.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure that they regret that decision, and I'm sure that they wish they would have fired. And that's the idea. It is a catch-22. But when you look at the opening question, Dan, where was the president justified in doing what he did in pardoning Clement Lawrence? 100%, and here's why. This is not a partisan answer. This is not a political answer. This is a legal answer because those five pieces of evidence would have shaped the entire outcome of the trial in favor of Lawrence. And another point here is Lawrence's defense counsel didn't do his job. Lawrence's defense counsel should have found all five pieces of the evidence we just discussed a moment ago and then sat with every paratrooper who was going to testify and interviewed them with one of his investigators ahead of trial, which is totally lawful and is derelict if you don't. And I submit to you as a former soldier and prosecutor and veteran of Afghanistan myself that had we slid across the table information that the Army produced that the people that were killed that day had killed American paratroopers and left their fingerprints and DNA on bombs, that those paratroopers' testimony would have been far different at trial.
Lawrence suggested when we spoke to him earlier this week that there was some political motivation for the military to railroad him in this case, just the sort of the political climate with respect to troop presence in Afghanistan and the perspective of well, Obama appointees. Do you agree that that played any part in this prosecution?
I do to an extent. I would offer episode 5 of the Leavenworth series that you opened with. Command Sergeant Major Gustafson was on the ground there. And as you may know, a Command Sergeant Major is the senior most enlisted advisor and is very well respected by all junior enlisted personnel as well as officers. And what you will see is he describes what happened. The entire chain of command, once it was reported that a civilian, a village elder, may have been killed, the civilian casualty balloon went up. And if you look, in March of 2012, in the neighboring district of Panjaway, Staff Sergeant Robert Bales shot and killed 16 civilians. So President Karzai and the Afghan government and the international coalition was rightfully outraged and expressed disdain for that type of action. Moreover, in June of 2012, in Zaire, another American sergeant shot and killed a man and his child, and nothing happened there. And President Karzai had just visited the Zaire district. So with all of that in mind, when Lawrence gave the order and one of the paratroopers said, oh, my God, one of those Afghans that we just shot looks like the village elder, the company commander, the battalion commander, the brigade commander, and the division commander turned their back on Lawrence and let him be characterized as a bad apple who was off the reservation in order to protect their own career trajectories for fear of having to answer for a civilian casualty. That's what I believe happened. And don't take my word for it. Take the Command Sergeant Major's word for it, who gave us a sworn declaration in our ongoing lawsuit in Kansas, and who also testified consistent with his sworn declaration on the STARS episode number 5 in the series Leavenworth.
He is John Maher. He's lead attorney and founder of Lawyers Defending Warriors. He was the attorney for Clint Lawrence, who was pardoned by President Trump in November as we were discussing the particulars of what happened on that fateful day in Kandahar province, and then subsequently with his prosecution, imprisonment, and ultimately freedom per the president's pen. John, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Dan and Amy, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the program.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hashtag Epstein didn't kill himself. Did you see Dr. Michael Bodden was on the Dr. Oz show yesterday? In addition to what we covered when the story was profiled on 60 Minutes, photos from the jail cell and whatnot, Bodden saying that capillaries in Epstein's eye sockets that had burst are also consistent with strangling in addition to the ligature marks and so on and so forth. So the plot continues to thicken, and DOJ would be wise to wrap up their investigation and
find that missing video, too.
Well, and prosecution of the two security guards, or coming to some kind of arrangement with the security guards so these blanks get filled in sooner rather than later.
It's news, opinion, insight.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This was a fun little hallway exchange between CNN's Manu Raju and Arizona Senator Martha McSally.
Senator McSally, should the Senate consider new evidence as part of the impeachment trial?
Manu, you're a liberal hack. I'm not talking to you.
You're not going to comment, Senator?
You're a liberal hack.
She said, and then she walked past doing like, liberal hack.
It's not just what she said. It's how she said it. The palpable disdain, I thought, was really a nice kicker. And then CNN went on to prove their liberal hackery by doing a story about John McCain's family not having any love lost with Martha McSally. How that's relevant.
No, it's not. It's like an eye for an eye. You said something about us. Well, we're going to say something about you. Well, she doubled down. She was on Fox News last night with Laura Ingraham.
As you know, I mean, these CNN reporters, but many of them around the Capitol, they are so biased. They are so in cahoots with the Democrats. They so can't stand the president. And they run around trying to chase, you know, Republicans and ask trapping questions. I'm a fighter pilot. You know, I called it like it is.
Well, even more than that, how about the debate moderator's performance? Mm-hmm. Which has come under pretty severe criticism and I think fairly warranted. Not only are they in cahoots with the Democrats, per Martha McSally, with specific Democrats, and the accusatory tone. I mean, you know, you have people like John Cass rallying to the defense of Bernie Sanders, not because he shares any political views of Bernie Sanders, of course, but writing about it because it just wasn't on the up and up, that debate performance where they focused in on the allegations about what was said or wasn't said at this dinner between Warren and Bernie and Matt Taibbi, who we've had on the show, man of the left, Rolling Stone. He said this about CNN, quote, over a 24-hour period before, during, and after the debate, CNN bid farewell to what remained of its reputation as a non-political actor via a remarkable stretch of factually dubious reporting, bent commentary, and heavy-handed messaging. Where's James Earl Jones with the "This is CNN" when you need him?
Well, the commentator didn't say, "Did you say that, Tori?" She said, "Why did you say that?"
For more on this topic and, of course, all things impeachment-related, we're pleased to be joined by Brett Baer, Fox News anchor, special report, 5 p.m. Chicago time, and weekdays, of course, and then author also of the newly released book, 3 Days at the Brink, FDR's Daring Gamble to Win World War II. Brett, thanks for joining us.
Morning.
Fun times inside the Beltway there. And just starting with, I mean, since you're a debate moderating professional and so forth, what about the criticism coming from the left and the right in defense of somebody that they may not necessarily otherwise want to defend on a political basis, Bernie Sanders, with respect to how that debate was run by CNN?
Yeah, I think it's warranted. I'm willing to give Abby Phillips the benefit of the doubt, and it was just a screw-up. But it just felt like Bernie Sanders was taking a lot of incoming in that debate and that it was set up to do such. Biden wasn't set up for any cross-examination. And, you know, I was surprised that the fellow candidates didn't do more to confront Biden. But the questioners, you know, listen, when we set up debates, we were really tough, I thought, on Republican candidates in the primaries. We asked pointed questions and
Brett,
we're losing you a little bit.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're good now. I'm sorry. But you were just saying you asked pointed questions in the Republican debate.
That's pointed questions and then set it up so that you're debating policy issues among each other. And I just didn't feel like that was really happening, and I thought Bernie Sanders took a lot of incoming. So I think some of the criticism is fair. I think more importantly is the you know, panel after panel after panel that doesn't really seem, well, frankly, that balanced.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, what did we make of Elizabeth Warren charging at Bernie after the debate? She had to know that her lavalier mic was on.
Yeah, that also felt like a setup to me. You know, I guess other networks do the lavalier mic. We never did. We just did the mics on the podium.
Oh, really?
So, but it does capture that those moments. And of course she knew what exactly was happening. And, you know, I just also thought it was weird. They had the audio the night before. They had hours of coverage. Why did it take a day to release?
Mm.
I don't know.
Maybe
covering media.
Maybe they were trying to edit out Tom Steyer saying hi to Bernie because it was so obsequious and weird. Maybe that.
Although I do think that for all the people, including me, who at times have said the awkward, hey, I just wanted to say hi, that really was a Tom Steyer moment.
He had his Christmas tie on. I mean, it was so goofy.
Somebody's in an argument and you say, hey, I just want to say hi.
I know. It was,
I just want to say hi. And then Bernie's like, yeah, good. I hate billionaires.
Yeah,
have you
good.
Not heard everything I've said for the last 30 years?
But do you think Warren and Bernie, they're out of time to repair this rift? I mean, with the Iowa caucuses, what, 17 days away?
Yes, it's over. The love lost is, it's lost. And I think that it's really coming down to a split in the progressive side of the party. And, you know, the Bidens of the world, the Buttigieg's of the world love this. In addition, they're stuck in their seats in the Senate trial. And that's going to help them, the other candidates as well.
Speaking of Biden, Are House and Senate Democrats absolutely sure they want to demand witnesses be called? Do they really want Joe Biden to testify before the impeachment panel? You know, this is somebody who doesn't look like he would necessarily hold up under scrutiny that well. And it seems this week we've seen both representatives of the Obama camp and representatives of the Clinton camp trying to derail Bernie Sanders. If Biden is called to testify, aren't they concerned that that would derail Biden, who may have to be their default candidate?
Yeah, I think that there's going to be an argument about relevance, and they're going to say, you know, what exactly can he bring? And it's going to be really messy on this issue of witnesses. And Republicans are going to fight for one-to-one, as you say, one Democratic witness, one Republican witness. And, you know, is it the whistleblower? Is it Hunter Biden? Hard to believe it would be Joe Biden, but maybe. And I just don't think somebody like John Bolton is going to eventually testify. I think the battle over executive order, executive privilege rather, is going to be a long one and ultimately decided by Republicans who favor giving the president that power.
What do you think of Lev Parnas? And is Fox ever going to get an interview with him? The guy who looks like he's straight out of Central Casting?
Yeah, we've tried. It's obviously he has credibility issues. He's said some things before that are flatly not true, including that he met, I guess, with Nunes in Vienna. That didn't happen. Apparently there was a phone call. It's really messy, but there is explosive info. And if it all checks out and the paperwork and documentation checks out, I mean, it's potentially a problem for the administration.
You said you tried, but what kind of response? What he just said, no?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to get him to lock down. We're kind of talking to all his people, whoever that is. It's basically a law firm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. The lawyer who's been with him in those interviews. The Ukrainian foreign minister, Vadim Pristeko, did an interview with Christiane Amanpour that I don't necessarily think went how she hoped it would go, but basically said, look, I never met with Rudy. I never met with Lev. I don't believe what Lev is saying. I think there are a bunch of people trying to posture to make themselves more important than they are. I've been with Zelensky since before he was president, and we didn't need unofficial channels because the official channels to the White House were working just fine and continue to work just fine. And, basically, there is no there with what Parnas is saying, including but not limited to the idea that they were upset or they were slighted when neither Trump nor Pence came to the inauguration. And point of fact, the foreign minister saying we gave very short notice. We were happy to have Secretary Perry there. That was good enough for us. And all of this bluster really has nothing to do with our relationship or nothing to do with how the relationship has been proceeding since since before we got the military aid.
Yeah, I think that's a significant fact. I don't think that's how they thought that interview was going to go. And I think there's a lot of stuff in there that people need to hear. There have been some unsavory characters in this whole process of investigating the administration. I mean, remember Michael Cohen, remember Michael Avenatti, and a lot of them have at times tried to produce information or said they had information in order to get some kind of deal, to get out of trouble that they were facing. So I don't know if that's the case with Lev Parnas or not. I think more damaging potentially is if this is a long, long process and suddenly witnesses it's a cavalcade, and the discovery turns into the Senate trial turns into the House grand jury, and it becomes a discovery process. And that it's just an open variable, and you don't know where it's going to go.
Based on what McConnell said on the Senate floor yesterday, waxing philosophic about golden pens and silver platters, combined with what Lindsey Graham has said, which he, quote, wants to get this crap over with as quickly as possible, it seems like the posture of Senate Republicans hasn't changed from sort of the Lindsey Graham position. You get your House managers, present your case, Trump's lawyers present their case, and let's call the question.
Yeah, I think that's what he's hoping for. I think there will be a battle on witnesses. And just reading through the tea leaves, these Republicans are not hiding the fact that they're going to probably vote for them. The question is how it's structured. And if it's one for one, are the Democrats willing to go down that road? If they are, it's going to be, it's going to be explosive in the middle of a primary and caucus season that will get overshadowed.
He is Brett Baer, Fox News anchor, special report, weekdays, 5 p.m. Chicago time, author of the book, 3 Days at the Brink, FDR's Daring Gamble to Win World War II. Brett, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right, see you guys.
Take care.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, picking up on our conversation with Brett Baer, Kellyanne Conway was on with Bill Hemmer yesterday on Fox talking about, of course, impeachment. How long does she expect this to go?
Quickly, a White House official was quoted in The Hill saying that it lasts no more than 2 weeks. Is that a general consensus of the White House, 2 weeks?
It seems about right for the following reason, Bill. We're not talking about short or long, protracted or brief, so much as full and fair. And full and fair with such thin evidence, such weak articles, these two articles are very weak. I mean, obstruction of Congress coming out of the process in the House, that we don't see the need to have a protracted, lengthy trial.
Yeah, I think that's right. Also, I mean, we're bumping up against the president's State of the Union address.
True. And he's supposed to go to Switzerland next week, and he said that he is still planning on going to the summit in Switzerland. Well, there was talk of him having to stay here, but
yeah, but the key is you don't want to address the nation with this thing still pending, because then you're going to be forced to address it again, or he's probably going to be incapable of not addressing it. You want to be able on that day, on that State of the Union address, to say, okay, we're beyond that now. So now let's focus on the people's business. That's the position Trump wants to be in. Let's focus on the people's business. We got a lot of big things to do. Here's what I have planned for this legislative session, this calendar year, and then, even obviously projecting out past November of 2020. That's the position he wants to be in. So Republicans need to move this along. I think that's right. Kellyanne Conway was asked.
I don't think it's going to happen, though. I don't think they'll be done by February 4th.
Based on what?
Well, I mean, isn't every manager, and correct me if I'm wrong, have 16 hours to 24 hours to explain their position on why these articles of impeachment, present the evidence? And then the senators can write questions down. And I just have a feeling that the Democrats are going to prolong this.
Well,
take their time and make it more messy for President Trump.
Yeah, they may try, although that may not ultimately serve their interests. If there's not agreement for example, on witnesses, then what do you got? You got your ability to present your case, and that's it. Kellyanne Conway on the topic of witnesses.
Well, the White House respects the Senate's role here constitutionally, and they will vote on whether or not to have witnesses. So we will let them do that. But I think what the Democrats are trying to do here is backdoor their failures in the House to actually rush through. Then they sat on the articles for a month. It made absolutely no sense. They rushed through. And I think that Senator Collins said it best yesterday, which is it sounds like they didn't do a thorough process. You can look at her actual statement that they should have gone and gotten things done there that they failed to do. And so why are they trying to backdoor in the Senate what the House failed to do? That shouldn't be allowed.
Yeah, and I think you also, if you're a Senate Republican, if you're the White House, you need to push to have these politicians up against a deadline. And that's right. Why I think the State of the Union is the obvious deadline to use to push to say let's move past this in January. You can't even get, generally speaking, the public's attention on this. No. They're interested in the other matters we should be tending to. And I say again, whoever is seen as getting to those other matters first will derive the associated political benefit.
And then did you see this? The Sergeant of Arms for the Senate handed out flashcards to every member of Senate yesterday, giving them tips on how to avoid the press during the impeachment trial. These are phrases to use. One, please move out of my way. You are preventing me from doing my job. My favorite one at the end is, please do not touch me.
Right. You're being touched, and then you have to refer to your laminated card that you got from the Senate Sergeant at Arms.
Excuse me. I'm trying to get to the Senate floor.
This speaks to the dizzying intellects that occupy so many of those seats in the Senate.
But do you think they're going to abide by this, especially the candidates who are running for president?
They're going to abide. There's no gag order. They're going to abide by it. They're going to be in the crucible, and they're going to want to leverage that position to serve their interests, particularly those that are running for president, of course.
I just don't know if I have the stomach to watch the relitigation of all of this again. It's the same song and dance, just a different theater.
Yeah.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer.
Coming up on Chicago's Morning Answer,
we're going to talk to two Venezuelan exiles who are making their way around to American college campuses, warning against the ravages of socialism. Stay tuned for that at 7:37.
But now let's head straight into the newsroom. Here is Mike Scott.
Skies are gray this morning. We have 17 degrees officially at O'Hare, 25 Lakefront at 7:30. American forces in Iraq are again partnering with Iraqi forces against ISIS. U.S.-led forces suspended operations on January 5th. Pentagon said then that American stationed in Iraq needed to reinforce security at Iraqi bases that house coalition troops after a U.S. drone strike killed Iran's top general. U.S. military says nearly a dozen U.S. troops were treated for concussions after the Iranian missile attack in Iraq earlier this month. NBC's Richard Engel.
A military spokesman said that 8 service members have been transferred to Germany, 3 to Kuwait, but that they are expected to return to service here in Iraq after those screenings.
No service members were killed when Iran fired over a dozen missiles at 2 Iraqi bases. Democrats are calling for fair impeachment trials to begin in the Senate. The president was impeached by the House for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. The Senate trial begins on Tuesday. A winter storm getting set to hit the Chicago area during the afternoon rush. National Weather Service says mixed precipitation is expected throughout the region. We'll start with snow, then have ice, and then possibly some rain and return back to snow. And a winter weather advisory will be in effect throughout Chicagoland tonight through tomorrow morning. 3 boys and 2 men are in stable condition after another Chicago mass shooting, this inside a barber shop on Chicago's west side. An 11-year-old, 12-year-old, and 16-year-old, and 2 men suffered gunshot wounds. Authorities are still searching for that gunman. A Catholic high school in suburban River Grove is closing at the end of the school year. Garing College Prep announcing the school will close its doors for good on June 30th. A $5,000 reward is being offered for information leading to the arrest in the deadly shooting of a man outside a church on Chicago's South Side. Police say Imoni Aduma was shot and killed Wednesday night in the 1200 block of West 78th Place near St. Sabina Church. And this morning, Florida Senator Rick Scott is applauding the Peace Corps for, in his words, finally coming to their senses. The Peace Corps has announced this morning it will wind down operations in China. Senator Scott says he's been pushing for this decision for months. The Republican yesterday saying he's glad to see the Peace Corps finally acknowledging Communist China is an adversary to the U.S. and its own people. Bulls visit the Sixers later on tonight. Blackhawks will visit the Maple Leafs tomorrow night. College hoops last night. Loyola knocked off Southern. Illinois State fell in the Valley to Drake. The news, a service of Staples. Staples has a weekend exclusive deal with a big discount. This weekend, only Apple AirPods with charging case are only $139. Hurry into your local Staples where there's a whole lot more in store this weekend. In-store only, offer valid 117 to 119 20. While supplies last, limit to Staples. 7:33 and a check of traffic and weather on the way next on AM 560.
Sean Hannity explains the conflict with Iran.
None of this should be really hard to understand. It's not that difficult to know that this is a huge, huge step forward to making the world a safer place with all the evil that we know exists in it. We are talking about the number one state sponsors of terrorism around the globe.
The Sean Hannity Show. Afternoons at 2 on AM 560. The Answer.
When it's cold outside, you can dress for it. But when your furnace gives out, hey, a blanket fort can only do so much. So call your local one-hour heating and air conditioning. We'll replace your old furnace with a new high-efficiency one. And that beats a bunch of blankets any day. Right now, cozy up to big savings on a complete heating system. Call 855-1-HOUR.
Your comfort is just a call away. Call 1-HOUR.
Terms and conditions may apply. Call for details. Independently owned and operated. Licensed in the respective state or county.
Attention retirees and pre-retirees. Do you really understand how your money works? Do you know how much of it could be lost in a market crash? Are you confident you won't run out of money in retirement? You can get answers by attending a Wealth Management Group educational two-part class hosted at Harper College in Palatine. Call 833-WMG-PLAN right now or go online to investwithwmg.com. All investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities and advisory services offered through LPL Financial, a registered investment advisor. Member FINRA SIPC.
Listen to AM 560, The Answer, online at 560theanswer.com, on the AM 560 mobile app, and your Alexa-powered smart speaker, on TuneIn, iHeart, and radio.com.
7:35, AM 560 Traffic Center Time, and Jim Talamonte.
Inbound, Kennedy delays start at Nagel. It's 40 minutes O'Hare to downtown, 25 for Montrose, 21 in the Express. Outbound, 30 minutes to the airport. The Edens is now fine. Inbound Eisenhower, traffic's heavy, 25th to Austin and Pulaski to the Burns Circle. 40 minutes, 390 to downtown. Outbound, just 30. Inbound Stevenson, delays start at Cast, 42 minutes, 355 to Lakeshore Drive. Outbound, 35. Inbound Ryan Canal Port, crash is cleared, but we're seeing delays starting around 51st. It is 25 minutes, 95th to downtown. I-57, 18 minutes, I-80 to the merge, Bishop 428. Southbound Lakeshore Drive is now heavy from Montrose to Belmont. Northbound Tri-State delays from the Hinsdale Oasis to 47th and Reagan Tollway to the Ike. I'm Jim Talamonte on AM 560, The Answer.
We're hearing news this morning out of St. Louis, where a Delta plane has just skidded off the runway. Keeping our eyes on that as bad weather is draping Missouri and headed for us this afternoon with accumulations of snow beginning during the afternoon rush. High of 30, periods of snow 1 to 3 inches, changing to ice overnight, low 28. 16 at O'Hare, 25 Lakefront. Your next news update is at 8, and Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy continues next on AM 560, The Answer.
This hourly segment is brought to you by HealthQuest Radio with Dr. David Kolbaba. Every Saturday morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning, Dan and Amy. And as we've had Comrade Bernie's Iowa apparatchik extolling the virtues of gulags this week, thanks to the undercover work of Project Veritas, James O'Keefe, his team.
Oh my God. Just when you think it couldn't get more progressive.
Progressive?
Well,
totalitarian. Yeah. Gulags to re-educate people, to de-Trump them, de-Trumpify them after dear leader Bernie's victory in November. Remarkable. Remarkable. Remarkable that somebody who was lauding the Cuban economy 30 years ago as better than the United States, singing the praises of the Soviet Union 30 years ago.
They loved their train system. He loved the chandeliers and the
puppet shows.
Platforms, yeah.
Puppet shows, very affordable. Mm-hmm. On Soviet soil, could be a leading contender for the Democrat Socialist nomination for president, but it's real. It's happening. And, of course, we've talked about the survey research showing how attractive words like socialism, even communism, are to millennials and younger, even those younger than millennials who are on college campuses right now. It calls to mind Alexander Solzhenitsyn, of course, Gulag Archipelago, and what he wrote about 35 years ago, about the time Bernie was jaunting off to the Soviet Union with Jane for their honeymoon. Solzhenitsyn, who ironically was in exile from the Soviet Union in the 80s in Vermont. Apparently, Bernie and Alexander didn't cross paths. He wrote, "If I were asked today to formulate as concisely as possible the main cause of the ruinous revolution that swallowed up some 60 million of our people, I could not put it more accurately than to repeat, men have forgotten God. That's why all of this happened." Talking about the communist repression during the life of the Soviet Union in the 20th century. Well, this certainly brings to mind Venezuela, which is an example that none of the Democrat Socialists in America want to talk about. But it's very real, and it has appeal in certain quarters on the left. We know because a contingent of the Chicago Teachers Union went down to Caracas to praise the school system under Maduro in Venezuela, incredibly. And then they came back here and rewarded with a pay raise the city of Chicago can't afford. But no, of course, nothing like what happened in the Soviet Union, nothing like what happening in Venezuela could happen here, right? Well,
no one knows what's happening in Venezuela but a Venezuelan.
We've talked to Venezuelans on the ground before, and we're pleased to be joined by two more who are exiles of Venezuela, Jorge Galicia and Andres Guiarte, are touring college campuses in America, trying to disabuse college students of the notion that socialism will usher in some utopian wonderland. Andres, Jorge, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having us, Dan and Amy.
Hello, good morning. Thank you.
Jorge here.
Good morning. So whoever wants to start, Andres, why don't we start with you? Tell us about, you guys are both in your mid-20s, so you're millennials. Tell us about what you're conveying to students on college campuses in America about what you know about your home of Venezuela.
Sure. Well, actually, the message we're trying to give these students is a worrying message. It's a worrying message that those policies that they hear from some politicians, you know, are the same policies that our society used to hear in the mid-80s and in the 90s, even before Chavez came to power. Because all Venezuelan problem is not just about Chavez, it's even before him. So we're trying to give them a warning that all this news they see about Venezuela, all the violence, that's just the conclusion of a whole story that started with some politicians trying to start giving free stuff to people. And that's what we're trying to give to the students.
Jorge, I want to ask you what happened. I mean, you were born and raised in Venezuela, and just tell me how your country changed.
Well, what happened is easy. I think we as a country started to spend much more than we were actually able to afford, you know. Mm-hmm. Politicians back in the 70s, I think the 70s is the decade where all of our troubles as a society began. Because in that decade, thanks to the big oil revenue that the government was receiving thanks to the oil market, they started to create a lot of social programs designed to allegedly help the poor, right? Free healthcare, free college tuition, free housing, free whatever. All of that was great for a moment because Venezuela had money to spend, but eventually we run out of money. And that's when the problems began. All of those programs were not sustainable. And when politicians tried to, you know, to fix the system by making cuts to the budget, the people were already really dependent on all of these social programs. So to fix the budget was literally impossible.
Yeah, but what hardships did you face?
Well, because people was so dependent, when politicians tried at the end of the 80s to cut the budget, people went out to the streets like crazy to start rioting against the government, a lot of looting. So it was literally impossible for us to fix the budget, and because of that, we ended up electing Hugo Chavez because he was the only one promising more socialism and more, hardcore leftist ideas. And I think this is important because a lot of people from the left here say, well, you know what, in the Venezuelan example is not a good one because we are proposing, a welfare state. We're not proposing a hardcore socialism like the one they have in Venezuela. But what they're not realizing is that welfare state, big welfare state, is precisely what got us into hardcore socialism afterwards. So the people have to take care about the budget here in America because I just read that the debt here, it already surpassed 23 trillion. Mm-hmm. And if you don't control that, you will probably end up in a really bad economic situation.
Yeah, it's interesting you point out how there's an evolution to this, right? It happened gradually over the course of several generations and then suddenly under Chavez and now Maduro. And it was the unwillingness to live within your means and instead to believe beautiful lies that were told by politicians. I just want you to talk to how socialism was marketed in Venezuela and the similarities between some of the rhetoric you heard from politicians there and what you're hearing from politicians in America.
Sure. One of the key similarities will be like when Chavez got to power, he never called himself a socialist. He said he was a humanist. But as soon as he got to power, like 1 year later, he started this agenda about 21st century socialism. And he started with something that you hear in America, like, you know, we need to empower the poor, being rich is bad, this kind of stuff. And since Venezuela was not going through a really good moment, and there was a lot of population living in poverty, well, Chavez was just trying to speak to those people. And you know, when that's one of the problems with the government and the politicians is that it's really easy when you make a campaign and just speaking like we're going to help poor people, we're going to start giving free stuff, we're going to attack the rich because they're the problems of society. And a lot of people like to hear that kind of message, and that was one of the key factors that helped the socialism get the spread in the country, and also because Chavez was a really charismatic person in the moment.
And so, what's the sense from Venezuelan families now about the bill of goods they were clearly sold? Do you think there is a recognition of the road to perdition that they were led down?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the last time I read some polls on the ground in Venezuela, I heard more than 80% of the society already rejects the very same word of socialism. You know, nobody wants to talk about socialism anymore. They want people in Venezuela already want one market. They don't want free stuff anymore because they know it is an impossibility. Actually, you know what's funny? Every time, you know, in the past when the government announced, that they wanted to raise the minimum wage, everybody started to celebrate because they thought that that was a good idea. Now everybody knows for a fact that everybody, even the the poorest section of the society, they don't like when the government say that they will raise the minimum wage, because they know for a fact that they will start losing jobs, that they will get fired, that the prices will start getting even higher than whatever it is today. So I really believe that we have learned our lessons, but you know, we needed to do that through the hard way. No, my expectations to America is that I hope that you are a mature enough society so you can learn from other people's experience, so you don't have to go through any of the hard results that we needed to in order to understand what socialism is about, right?
So how are you guys being received on college campuses here? How are the students reacting to what you have to say?
Well, so far it's more positive than anything situation, because our message, I mean, we speak from a personal perspective. I mean, we show, I just have one year here, and Jorge has a year and a half. So we have a really fresh perspective of what is living under socialism hell. So I mean, family is there. My whole family is in Venezuela. So we get this perspective, this message, this real experience over there. And, you know, there's you can't disagree with what we're saying. We know what we're talking about. So the only disagreement we find in these college campuses is, it's like, okay, everything that is going on in Venezuela is horrible, but that's not going to happen here in the U.S. And some politicians, they're not trying to get the Venezuelan model. They're trying the Nordic model. Like, for example, that's what Bernie says, that he doesn't want that socialism. He wants the Nordic socialism. And therefore, we have to make researches about the Nordic models in order to answer these questions. And the more common answer is, in the Nordic countries, there is no socialism. That is actually capitalism. And what happened in Venezuela is real socialism. And the key similarity is that before everything happened in Venezuela, everyone said that we're not going to be like Cuba. And we end up being worse than Cuba. So when everyone starts saying that they're not going to be like Venezuela, that's like the wrong path, because you're going to end up worse than Venezuela.
Well, right. I mean, why, if you're pursuing the same policies, Bernie Sanders, government takeover of health care, government for free college, free this, free that, entitlement this, entitlement that, if you're going to pursue the exact same policies and set up the same systems that were set up in Cuba and Venezuela, why would it turn out any different?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's what is most, you know, I worry a lot when I see all of these proposals from the Democratic field, you know, Medicare for all, college free for all, expand Social Security. I mean, all, you know, both political parties should be discussing how to, you know, to lower the levels of debt and the levels of public spending. They are already way too high. How are you going to afford even more Social Security, more Medicare, more free things? That is not sustainable. We should be discussing the other way around. How do we cut the budget? Because nobody in America seems to be caring about this anymore. And sadly, not even the Republican Party anymore. I mean, we just had a whole Congress controlled by the Republicans, and the presidency, of course, in hands of Trump. And you know, the deficit is still growing. So what's going on here?
Yeah, that's a fair point.
That's really sad, you know.
Well, one other parallel. I mean, that's a salient point. One other parallel I just wanted to get to was nationalizing of industry. Hugo Chavez nationalizing the oil sector and destroying the lifeblood of the Venezuelan economy. And what we have going on here with the proposals for the Green New Deal to deindustrialize the American economy and transform our energy sector.
Yeah, that was and still is one of the key factors that led to this disaster in Venezuela. Because and you have to go back to the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, because the national debt at that moment was just growing and growing and growing. And the government started, you know, to print money to take money from somewhere. And that created inflation. And but Chavez went even farther, and he started nationalizing a lot of industries. So, and not just industry, even stores. I mean, he just wanted to take everything he could to gain more money. And the thing is that eventually all these industries and businesses that they nationalized, they all went to bankruptcy because they didn't, they don't know how to take this industry to, to actually make profit. So that is one of the key factors that destroyed the whole industrial complex of Venezuela. And that, you're right, that's one of the key similarities here, because eventually when the government wants to, finance everything and give a lot of stuff to everyone, they have to get the money from somewhere. And it seems like pockets of the citizens is not enough. So they want to get businesses and they want to get a lot of industries. And eventually, everything just falls apart.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Jorge Galicia, Andres Gallarte. These are two Venezuelan young men that are traveling to college campuses around America, telling the story about Venezuela as a cautionary tale. Appreciate what you're doing. Good luck on the college campuses, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, no, thank you so much for the invitation.
Okay. And they joined us both on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Good piece from our friend VDH, nationalreview.com. The new post-Trump constitution. The new constitution of the United States, post-President Trump. Here are some of the features. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Ready for the brave new world that the Democrat Socialists have ushered in post-President Trump? Well, currently, and then ultimately they're setting a precedent that will be referred to when unfortunately this is the way it goes. Some Republicans want to apply their tactics to their people. Number one, private presidential phone calls with foreign leaders will be leaked and printed in major media. Number two, impeachment is now a casual affair, no longer requires a report of illegal or unethical behavior by a special counsel or special prosecutor. It won't be bipartisan, but solely the action of the opposition party in the House when it's in the majority. Public support won't matter much. Much less will it be needed. Impeachment will be applied equally to a first or second term presidency. So it didn't matter if you have an electoral remedy. And it will become useful in a re-election year to help drive down the incumbent's popularity. That's certainly what the framers had in mind, didn't they? Three, no need for to specify treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors in any impeachment writ against the president. Just abstractions like obstruction and abuse of power are good enough. Special counsels and special prosecutors are now irrelevant. The Washington top echelon of the CIA, FBI, NSA will be largely immune from oversight. Reverse targeting of political opponents will be the normal behavior of intelligence agencies working closely with an incumbent lame duck administration. So, let's say Trump loses in 2024. Well, let's say he gets reelected in 2020, right. And then, so he'll be out in 2024.
Right.
So in advance of the 2024 election, he'll weaponize the FBI and the CIA to engage in political espionage against whoever the Democrat nominee for president is in 2024.
Oh, just like Obama did.
So does that sound
with
right?
Trump, yeah.
Demasking
people too and things.
Yeah. Is that what you think is appropriate? That the kind of free society you want to live in? That's political fair play. Seventh, the media like academia and Hollywood are now an extension of the Progressive Party. Like, for example, CNN, as we've been discussing off and on this morning. Presidential candidates can hire foreign nationals to aid their campaign by collecting embarrassing innuendo and rumor. And then used both high government officials and members of the Washington and New York media to disseminate and publicize damaging rumors about a political rival, right? Steele dossier. FISA courts will favor status quo government narratives, especially in matters of controversial candidates and political races. Whistleblowers never need to be identified. This is the new political climate. And VDH writes, it's obvious that both George Bush and Barack Obama could have easily been impeached under such protocols after they lost their party's majority in the House of Representatives. From now on, their successors will enjoy no such exemptions. We are now on new anti-constitutional grounds, and the United States will probably never return to the constitutional customs and traditions of its first 233 years. So that's what we should be prayerful about. That's why this moment is a somber one. That's why we should be reluctant to encourage the abuse of powers enshrined in the Constitution for the House and the Senate, respectively, which is where the real abuse of power is currently ongoing.
Well, when I was watching the articles of impeachment, you know, in that dramatic form and fashion being transferred, I was watching with Peyton and Eli, and I said, wow, I never thought in my lifetime I would see this again. I said, but now that this has happened to President Trump, you guys are probably going to see this a lot more than you think. I thought with Bill Clinton, I was one and done. Wasn't around for Nixon. I know you think I'm that old, but wasn't. So this is now going to be the new norm. If you don't like a candidate, if you can't beat him in the ballot box, then impeach him. Find something. Make his life hell and his family's and his associates' lives miserable in the process.
And lest you forget and forget to share some of the indelible moments of the week within your circles of influence, Mitch McConnell encapsulated them nicely for you to memorialize in a speech on the Senate floor yesterday.
After weeks of delay, the Speaker of the House decided yesterday that a trial could finally go forward. She signed the impeachment papers. That took place, Madam President, at a table with a political slogan stuck onto it. And they posed afterwards for smiling photos. And the Speaker distributed souvenir pens to her own colleagues emblazoned with her golden signature that literally came in on silver platters. The pens literally came in on silver platters. Golden pens on silver platters. A souvenir to celebrate the moment.
Silver platters, does that name ring a bell to you?
The Brady Bunch, weren't they the silver platters?
Exactly.
Oh, that's right.
Keep on moving.
Are we going to keep on dancing?
Thankfully, Maureen McCormick was the lead and you were not.
We're going to keep on. I won't sing the rest.
In addition to that, what McConnell had to say about those prayerful, somber, reluctant Democrats, they were celebratory upon the signing of the Articles of Impeachment and the Our Lady of Guadalupe procession over to the Senate with them, and then positively giddy yesterday with what they thought was new bits of important evidence that the Senate would have to consider. The Lev Parnas allegations and his interviews on CNN and MSNBC, and then this GAO report that suggests that the administration broke the law by withholding security funds for Ukraine back last summer. That is disputed by the Office of Management and Budget. And again, GAO is an administrative body that serves the legislature, serves Congress. It is not a law enforcement body. But nonetheless, this is what they're hanging their hat on. Let's start with Lev Parnas. Well, let's start with Mike in Park Ridge, and then we'll go to Lev Parnas.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Mike, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I think you used the right term, Dan. It's somber. And let's call a spade a spade. What's really happening here is the country is getting divorced. This happened before in the 60s. Not the 1960s, the 1860s.
So I
love this country.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And it's getting split apart, and that's what happens when you empower the extreme partisans on both sides of the political spectrum with protected class status.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Mike. Take your calls. With respect to Lev Parnas and the allegations he made yesterday that, the nature of them, even if you took what he said at face value, which I'm not suggesting you do, I don't know exactly what he's got. If he were accurate in everything he said, that Bill Barr was involved and so on and so forth, then I guess he would have Bill Barr speaking untruths, but the Justice Department has rejected the characterization that Parnas made.
And they said Bolton and Trump and Pence knew about everything, and Bolton disagreed with some things. But he sounded creepy. I mean, like he's stalking Trump. Listen to him with Anderson Cooper.
I idolized him. I mean, I thought he was the savior.
That's when he's idolized President Trump. Mm-hmm. He was the savior.
Well, it's so interesting.
You forgot to watch
his views on President Trump and whether they liked each other or not or what happened. Couldn't care less. Couldn't care less. What is he saying things that are true, or is he saying things that are untrue? This was some, again, personnel decisions here in the Trump administration and in Trump world generally. This is some flunky that was some hanger-on of Giuliani, and he was part of whatever Giuliani was doing in Ukraine. So,
because he was born there, Trump, and so he had a foot in.
Trump knew that Giuliani was in Ukraine. He dispatched him. The particulars of what he knew vis-a-vis whatever Giuliani was doing, unclear. But that's not what Parnas is alleging. He's alleging things. He's alleging, this was always about Biden. He's alleging things that are contained in part in the transcript of the July 25th call between Trump and Zelensky. And then he's imputing onto those things ill motives and then suggesting things that he doesn't know to be true. And now have been rejected by the Ukrainian foreign minister, such as the pressure that was ostensibly being put on the Zelensky administration by both the president and then the vice president.
And he says, President Lev says that President Trump's lying. He knows me. Look at all these pictures. And every time President Trump says that he doesn't know me, I'm going to tweet out another picture of us together.
So what? What does that prove?
Well, here's Trump.
What is your response to Lev Parnas, who says that your efforts in Ukraine were all about 2020. You just wanted Joe Biden out. What's your response?
Well, I don't know him. I don't know Parnas, other than I guess they had pictures taken, which I do with thousands of people, including people today that I didn't meet, but just met him. I don't know him at all. Don't know what he's about. Don't know where he comes from. Know nothing about him. I can only tell you this thing is a big hoax. It's a big hoax.
And again, some of the pictures, he was clearly in tow with Rudy Giuliani when he took a picture of the president. And lest we forget, he's under federal indictment of the Southern District of New York for campaign finance related charges. And he's essentially trying to leverage his value as an impeachment witness to try to serve his interests in avoiding prosecution or lessen a potential punishment for the crimes he's alleged to have committed by federal authorities in New York.
And he was so goofy last night. He turned to the camera, had his like up close moment when he was talking with Anderson Cooper, and he's like, "Members of Congress, I'm here. You know how to get a hold of me. I would like to testify."
Yeah,
such drama and fanfare. Get over it. He loves the attention, and he'll say anything to stay out of prison.
He wants a star turn. This was very reminiscent of Michael Cohen, very reminiscent of Michael Avenatti. And we know how that worked out for those two Michaels.
How did it end for both of them?
Vadim Prosteko, Ukrainian foreign minister. Zelensky's right-hand guy when it comes to these geopolitical matters and communications with the United States, both the president and his administration, members of Congress, particularly as it relates to military aid. Here's what he said.
It's all Ukrainian media as well today and yesterday. And strangely enough, my name was not mentioned, although I'm Minister of Foreign Affairs. And frankly, I never spoke with this individual. And again, frankly, I don't trust any word he is now saying. The assistance which he is referring to was reviewed on each and every year annually, at least twice, and half a year at the end of the year. So we knew that this assistance is to be reviewed. Sometimes it would be cut because of some political understanding of what is to be done in Ukraine, sometimes being erased, which is now we're observing. At the end of the year, we would receive even more than it was planned. I understand that this individual, which I don't know personally, but he is now trying to save his own case. And I don't trust what he is saying. And I would, I was so tired of these questions about our role in impeachment. What we are trying to tell Americans that we are so happy to have bilateral support from both parties. And we will be happy to have it as well. Thank you.
And a specific allegation that Parnas made, again, that Pence was dispatched as an emissary of Trump's to put pressure on Zelensky. And they were going to no-show the inauguration. And that's why they did, because he didn't launch the Burisma investigation. That's essentially what Parnas had suggested in those interviews. Well, here's what Prosteco says to that.
I can tell you why. We had some blame can be on our side because we had to do it in a very fast way. President Zelensky wanted to leave the parliament free from his new presidency, and we have just a couple of days to make it legal. We've been limited by ourselves by time. So we gave quite a short notice to all the nations. And in our case, in the American case, Secretary Perry came. We believe that we would have somebody else if we want to, if we give more time for the foreign delegations. So it was not a big deal for us. At least we didn't feel it. Whatever these individuals are saying, we invited, giving just 1 week prior notice to delegations, and we received Secretary Perry, which was a good representation and good level, and I was at the conversations with Secretary Perry as well. Mm-hmm. And anything of the sort you were just referring never been mentioned in none of these conversations.
Hmm. So why aren't Democrats calling the Ukrainians liars? Why not get after Zelensky and Prosteco? Aren't they liars? They didn't know when they were getting pressured. That's what Democrats are here to tell them. Well, they don't feel it. They didn't feel it then. They, upon reflection, still not the case. What about that? It's a difficult thing to explain, isn't it? Mark on the West Side.
Yeah, the one thing I have not heard is any sort of a defense for Trump. And he's got all these people that could easily clear his name, but he blocks them from testifying. What's your answer to that?
My answer to that is you have somebody exerting their rights, executive privilege, and the Democrats have every opportunity to litigate that if they want. With respect, I'm not done. With respect to people that
typical.
Offer with typical, yeah, I'd like to finish my answer. I let you finish your question. So you want to shut up and listen, or do you want to go away?
You don't like when people have a point against you.
No, I don't.
I don't want to hear that.
No, I have
you're busy spinning.
I actually have. I actually have no problem.
Let some truth come
I
out.
Actually have no problem. I let you ask your question, and I was answering, and then you interrupted because, in point of fact, you're the one spinning, and you don't want to listen and answer. You just want to talk over me, and unfortunately, Mark, it's not your show. Later. So as I was saying, now that I'm not going to be interrupted by Mark. Because that's not how it works, you punk. You had the president assert his rights, his executive privilege within his rights. What would your lawyer tell you to do if you were his client? Assert your rights or not assert your rights? And then you have courts of law to litigate the matter. The House Democrats chose not to pursue that remedy. That's a fact. In terms of other people rallying to the president's defense, on the sum and substance of his conduct, I could send you as many op-eds as could fill the studio we're in of people suggesting from the OMB to the transcript of the phone call that this, even if you don't like the particular language, even if you don't like the particular intonations, this is nothing that rises to the level of an impeachable offense. Even if you want to characterize it as some sort of quid pro quo offering, it still doesn't, which is, by the way, what I've been saying. And people like Andy McCarthy, who's actually a formal federal prosecutor, not just a crank on the West Side, have been saying from the outset. So to suggest that people haven't offered a defense of Trump on the substance of the matter is wrong. Wrong. What Democrats don't have is a case. They don't have a statute that was violated. They don't have a credible argument based on the merits, in not just the outcome, which is the aid being transmitted, but the process leading up to that outcome. And they don't have an answer to other people offering a defense of Trump. You know, the recipients of that aid that were supposedly being pressured, that he was supposedly bribing and extorting, who didn't bend to his alleged will when it came to investigating Burisma and the Bidens. Mark, on the West Side, what do you have to say about that? See, you don't want to answer questions, actually. You want to interrupt after you ask a question to then offer ad hominem because you're a child. You're a bedwetter. You're a leftist crank blinded by your own hate of Trump. You can hate him all you want. It doesn't make a colorable claim. Ralph and Rantoul, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. We also have somebody with a sense of history that you don't want to open up the office and set precedent for sharing things, hence the rare sharing of a presidential transcript, which I believe hadn't been done before. But the person my call is, you know, this dude can tweet out all the pictures that he wants with him standing next to Trump, around Trump. Just in my corporate career and my public work, I appear in pictures with people I don't know, as do you. I mean, when I met you at the Donna Brazile talk, you know, we could have snapped a picture, and my producing a picture of myself standing next to you would prove absolutely nothing, because at the end of the evening, you still don't know me. All I have is a picture next to you. It's preposterous. It's not evidence of knowing somebody.
Thanks for the call, Ralph.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity. This afternoon at 2 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. New York Times reporting on a recent study that suggests raising the minimum wage could lower suicide rates.
That $1.50 is really going to change it. I'm pulling for you.
The study examined suicide rates from 1990 through 2015 across all 50 states and Washington. Measured how they changed as the minimum wage increased over that time period. At the state level, of course. Researchers focusing on adults between 18 and 64 with a high school education or less, a group more likely than others to be affected by changes of the minimum wage. This was done by a doctoral student in epidemiology at Emory University. When controlling for changes in the state's economy and welfare policies, the researchers estimate that a dollar increase in the minimum wage corresponded with a 3.5% decrease in the suicide rate for those with a high school education or less. Without some of the controls, the decrease in suicide was 6%. The effect most pronounced during times of high unemployment. Doctoral student, John Kaufman, concedes there are possible alternative explanations to what we saw, but these aren't crude associations. These aren't mere correlations. We designed the study to account for multiple types of alternative explanations. A spokesman for Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah responding to this study. Our reading was the paper showed that a higher state minimum wage over the federal minimum wage is correlated with less suicide. By this logic, if we raise the federal minimum wage while keeping the state minimum wage constant, suicide would go up. Or we could really reduce suicide by eliminating the federal minimum wage entirely, thus creating a huge gap between the state minimum wage and the federal one. These seem nonsensical. Yeah. Also, just the underlying contention or premise, really, that the trend upward in suicide, as Dr. Leonard Sachs describes it when we spoke with him, is mainly attributable to your hourly wage, or significantly attributable to your hourly wage, and that the hourly wage increase would have that kind of impact across that population. Sort of runs afoul of historical data. So it's the same thing as saying, well, it's drug and alcohol abuse. Well, point of fact, in this particular cohort, drug and alcohol abuse has not increased significantly over the time period prior to the trend upward now to current. So there's something else going on that explains the trend going up at a maybe not a 45-degree angle, but maybe a 30-degree angle. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined, generally speaking, we're pleased to be joined by Nicholas Eberstadt. He's the Henry Wendt Chair in Political Economy at the American Enterprise Institute. He's the author of the forthcoming book, How to Educate an American, The Conservative Vision for Tomorrow's Schools. Well, that will be worth a read. And he wrote an expansive piece for nationalaffairs.com about the percentage of men of working age who are not working, and not because they're not job opportunities, but because they've effectively dropped out of the labor market. Nicholas Eberstadt, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for inviting me.
Before we get to the piece that I'm referencing, did you have any immediate reaction to that study about suicide that we were describing?
I haven't read it yet, so I don't think I can offer any informed assessment.
Okay, fair enough. In your piece, it's interesting, you start with sort of the demand-side explanations for the decrease or the stasis in male employment and the things that are talked about a lot, the changing economy and people that need that without the college diploma that need to do skills retraining and those sorts of phenomenon, those sorts of challenges. But then you go into the less talked about aspect of why there are a lot of men who could be in the labor market who aren't. You talk about the supply side dynamics that we don't talk a lot about. So talk about some of those supply side dynamics that factor in.
Sure. I mean, the received wisdom and the consensus is that the problem of men without work is a demand side issue, as you indicated. And there's a lot of truth in that. It certainly has been that way in the past, since more or less economies began. But we've got new things going on that I don't think we're paying enough attention to. I mean, consider this. The work rate, the employment to population ratio for guys who are called in the prime working ages, 25 to 54, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics designation, as of the most recent monthly jobs report, was almost up to the level that was reported for that same group in the 1940 census, which means in 1939. So we're almost up to 1939 work rates for prime age men in the United States today. It's a great depression scale problem. And four out of five of the men who do not have jobs are not looking for them. This is called the not in labor force group, the inactivity rate, there are different names for it. If you plot that inactivity rate from the mid-60s to the present, you get almost a straight line, almost a straight line. That doesn't make sense if you believe that this is a demand-side problem. If you believe it's a demand-side problem, you should have big shocks when we had the Great Recession, and you should have had visible shocks when we had previous recessions between 65 and 2008-2009, maybe also big shocks when China entered the World Trade Organization or when we came up with disruptive technologies. Can't see any of that stuff. Instead, you see almost a steady rising tide. That's not what a demand shock looks like. Give you another example. As we all know, the situation has been particularly brutal with men with lower educational attainment. And for guys who are high school dropouts, the work rates today look pretty dismal. But not having a high school degree is not consignment to labor force failure for everybody in this group. There are remarkably different paths that one can see within this group. For example, if someone is a foreign-born and married high school dropout, 25 to 54 years of age, their odds of being in the workforce, their labor force participation rate, is basically indistinguishable from an American native-born college grad. On the other hand, if you're born in the United States and you've never gotten married, your labor force participation rate is abysmal. It's barely over 50%. I mean, it's tragic. So within this single group of high school dropouts, we have a discrepancy in labor force performance of 40%. That doesn't look like something that's being driven by demand side constraints. There's something else big going on. And that's why I think we should be looking at what I call supply side problems or institutional barriers.
Well, so,
supply-side problems being motivation and institutional barriers being things that keep people from getting into the labor force.
So one of those barriers you're describing, marriage, that's a real equalizer, and ostensibly because of the responsibilities that are attached to marriage to support a family. One of the institutional factors, I think you suggest, is welfare state benefits.
Well, I would say that two supply side, two things that affect willingness, motivation, let's say, to be in the mix, are family structure and our disability questions, disability system questions. And an institutional constraint or impediment is having a felony in your background, because there's just a huge explosion of ex-cons. So if you, family structure is not something that a lot of social scientists are comfortable discussing these days. It's considered to be in poor form in many circles. But family structure is an absolutely powerful predictor of, among other things, male labor force participation. Now, I'm saying a predictor. That means that's a correlation. That doesn't necessarily mean causation.
Right.
I think anybody who looks at this knows that there's complicated causality, and it goes both ways. Okay. I mean, there are some people who may be, for example, ill, and that makes them less likely to be able to get married. But there's also being out of a family structure where you have obligations to a spouse and to children, which may have its own impact on your motivation to be in the labor force. What you can say is that it has, irrespective of educational level or ethnicity, the guys, prime age guys who've never been married, always have lower workforce participation levels than guys who are married. And furthermore, kind of interestingly, leave the marriage stuff aside, if a guy has kids under the same roof as him, regardless of whether he's married, separated, you know, divorced, never married, after you do those same controls, more likely to be in the workforce. You can call it a provider effect. What we've seen over the last half century and more, of course, is that the percentage of prime-age men who are never married has soared as the percentage of guys who are married has fallen radically. And the proportion of guys with children under 18 living in their household has also fallen dramatically. We would expect, all other things being equal, this to have a big depressing effect on male labor force participation in the U.S.
So that stands to reason. But what about what I did mention, which is the impact of welfare state benefits? If these guys aren't working, then they're surviving somehow, and I assume that at least partially on transfer payments.
So, unfortunately, for everybody, Uncle Sam forgot to ask how many people in America are receiving disability benefits. And because we have this kind of crazy quilt of different overlapping systems, you know, we've got Social Security Disability Insurance and SSI from the Social Security Administration, we've got veterans benefits, we've got workman's comp, we've got state and local benefits. There's no office anywhere that I can find that can come up with an accurate count of how many unique individuals are receiving one or more disability benefits. The best I could do was to look at a survey the Census Bureau does, which tracks a number of government benefit programs and tries to see how many people are participating in them. When you looked at that information, which is incomplete, back in 2013, and we're looking in the rearview mirror, a little less than 60% of the prime age guys who were out of the workforce were receiving one or more benefits. And about two-thirds of them lived in a household where somebody was receiving one or more of those benefits. And remember, resources are fungible in the household.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot higher than it was in the 1980s in that same survey. Okay, so nobody lives like a prince on disability. It's pretty penurious. I mean, it's a huge, you know, tragic waste of human potential, if it can be avoided, I'd say. At the same time, it's clear that that majority, maybe the overwhelming majority, of men who are not in the workforce are obtaining sustenance through one or more disability program. Eligibility in disability programs also qualifies people for other means-tested benefits. I don't think there's any way that social science can prove whether disability causes the men without work problem. You can't. You don't have a way of doing that. What you can show incontestably is that disability programs finance the continuation of the men without work program and is now a part of the budget of the majority, or perhaps the great majority, of men who are long-termers out of the labor force.
Very useful analysis. He is Nicholas Eberstadt. He holds the Henry Wendt Chair in Political Economy at the American Enterprise Institute. He's the author of the forthcoming book, How to Educate an American, The Conservative Vision for Tomorrow's Schools. And I will tweet out his piece from National Affairs about men not at work. Nicholas Eberstadt, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Take care.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.